Okay, so here we are, realigning with the natural world and our innate wholeness, one in the same. Reading Mick Collins' book, The Visionary Spirit, will certainly confirm our burgeoning awareness. This is Tributaries, and I'm your hostess, Robin. Mick, your latest book, The Visionary Spirit, comes off the heels of your book, The Unselfish Spirit. What is their link?
Well, interesting. Well, funny enough, I've just had another one published this year, but you're right, The Visionary Spirit was the second book. But the interesting thing about the connection between particularly the first two books and the third is that I passed through a spiritual crisis in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, and I spent many years trying to make sense of that in terms of what happened, why did I have this, and going into Jungian psychology, and, you know, I'd been very involved in Buddhism, and trying to work out a transpersonal sort of relationship to what I was left with, which was a very hard process to work through because it activated lots of deep complexes. So effectively, the book and now the trilogy has been a sequence of me asking deeper questions about my own experience and trying to find the literature that tells a story that makes sense to me. So effectively, I'm not writing a book from a place of knowing. I'm writing a from a place of trying to make sense of something that happened 30 plus years ago. And so there's a real trajectory through the work. And the idea is that I'm trying to now digest all of that and honor that process, because naturally when you write something like that, it's a call to live it.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. And you're writing about wisdom from the imaginal realm, which is science, myth, dreams, ancestors, near-death experience, indigenous wisdom, and more. But gosh, I have to just say that I love that you've included science as a piece of the imaginal realm. I'd love for you to share your take on all things being equal. Science has become or been deemed something of a god, it seems. And
yes,
in my mind, it is only one of these other views that we should consider or that could benefit from being considered equally.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've phrased that beautifully. And for me, yes, I think there is a branch of science, which I think we could safely call scientism, which has that view that it thinks itself as fairly much, asking all the right questions and trying to get the appropriate answers by virtue of its methodology and excluding a lot more information, which I think is the tragedy of scientism. But science in the way that it is could be expressed, and I would include the work of people like Carl Jung in that, and I can say a bit more about his methodologies that would make me make that stance. A lot of people might disagree with that. But Fritjof Capra's holistic science, there's a sense of, the web of life. And so for me, that real science of asking questions, the Latin for science is scientia, which is knowing. And you look at the word gnosis and the idea of knowing not only as a mental construct, but as a soulful, embodied, engaged with the wider field that we exist in, call it the cosmos or the universe or whatever, but we're not just an individual entity with a brain and the five senses. We're far more than that. We're imaginal beings. We're sort of connected to this wonderful universe that's alive. And so science that asks good questions and is not frightened to ask those questions, unlike scientism, which seems to be like the
yes,
the art or sack of knowledge, good science would really, really step up and embrace and I would imagine in its highest form would be quite ecstatic
about what
it was engaging in, you know, going, wow, you know, and I don't have an answer for this question, but wow, look what's happening. And yeah, so I get that feeling with people like Francesco Varela, who looks at this idea of autopoiesis, of self-creation, and that life is just coming into being, and we're part of that co-creative enterprise. So I think then you get some real buzz about how science can, you know, be a really beautiful thing, other than the kind of science that's maybe just in the laboratory cheering itself on, but excluding everything else as a variable. That worries me, that type of scientism. But yeah, I think it could be a very ecstatic process in its ability to open us up.
Yes.
Tonight.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mentioned Jung, and I would say why I would include
Please
Jung.
Please do,
with that,
yes.
Having read his great tome, The Red Book, a few times now, it became very clear to me that, and other people said this, that you've got this heuristic. He's going into his own experience as a way of researching his own experiences. And that's a body of inquiry called heuristic inquiry. Then he's reading texts and going around texts and then writing his own texts and refining them. And the interaction between his experiences and the writing and reading is this hermeneutics, which is another type of knowing and philosophy. But he's engaging deeply with embodied phenomenology and ways of being and intentional inquiries, which is all the scope of phenomenology. So I think that's a brilliant, you know, science, a real inquiry. And, you know, he went to some very interesting places. So I thank him enormously for that undertaking.
Absolutely. You write that enlivened soul can cope with the crushing order of scientism, but also I would say the literal collapsing of all systems as well. How can you speak to that from what you call an enlivened soul perspective?
What the fact that we're in a time of collapse?
Yes,
at the moment,
and our ability to cope.
Yeah, well, I think this is, you know, it's a bit like if you look at the old mystical philosophers going right back to the pre-Socratic Parmenides, you know, that we die before we die. And so actually collapse, if we try to shore up the edifice, we might find that we're just exhausting ourselves trying to shore something up that's outmoded, outdated, and finished. How about if we then said, hang on a minute, there's something about a collapse that maybe now will then, if we follow it and renew ourselves through the depths, through the soul, maybe this will lead to some new shoots and new beginnings that we have at the moment no idea how this would look, because it's never been done before on a collective scale like this. So there's a few things I would say about the soul. The first thing that would include individual soul work, that people are working on their dreams, working on breathing creating space in the soul for the spirit to be with and have those moments of embodied resonance with experience at a soul level. And that takes us then to the group soul, the anthropos. I mean, we're in the time of the Anthropocene, but it's interesting that in terms of the work we're doing, we've missed the anthropos, the group soul. And,
yes,
you know, the devil's in the details sometimes. We've just got a time of degradation called the Anthropocene. But actually, if we picked up the anthropos, the group soul, and made that part of our raison d'etre, how we connect, how we enliven each other and invite each other into depths and meet each other in those depths. And then finally to the anima mundi, the soul of the world, to have that resonant relationship at a soul level with all beings and all life. So I think the collapse of our outmoded, individualistic, egocentric, all of that stuff which seems to be feeding into the chaos of this time, if it collapsed, but if we had enough of a groundswell to pick up that sense of soul connection within, between, and with the wider, through our relationship with the wider field that we exist in, all the anima mundi, then I think we'd be in with a real shout to birth this new sort of era, this new time. I call that not the Anthropocene, because I think that's too anthropocentric, it's too human-centric. I think we need a deeper connection.
Yes, yes.
Resonant life. So I call that the Transformocene.
Yes, yes.
And
good
to
word.
Me, that is two words, two Latin words, transformo, change, and scene, a time of, a new era.
Mm. Well, you do love trees, I can tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you write that change is not an option. It's a necessity. And feeding into what we said off mic earlier, I'd love to add that it's a wonder as well. And there's so much fear constantly being advertised and bombarding us. Do you think embracing death is a necessary part for this shift to be happening, actual death, or is it more of a day-to-day living and just really living with the full presence of all of life?
Yeah, I think that if there is any death, it would be a sort of a metaphor for not literally dying. But of course, you know, that's always a prospect for all of us because we all face that potential. And I hope it doesn't happen just because of our recklessness, that we can preserve life through our efforts. But I do think the death is dying to what is outmoded and no longer serving us. But naturally, when we really become soulfully connected to our potential, I think that does bring wonder. It brings awe. It brings almost a vibrancy, the vital connection to living. And we can find that word, the numinous, and something which is totally part of our experience, but which is also beyond us, you know, that transpersonal connection that we have to life. But we have this spark within us, and I think the wonder is with that. So when we're walking through nature and we get touched by the sunlight coming through the leaves or the bird song or the river flowing, and yeah, that really, really awakens in us this sense of well, I kind of like that that lift, that uplift that it brings. And so I think the death is probably the death of the individualistic, outmoded form of consciousness that really is leading us into this cul-de-sac of no way out.
Yes. I have a friend who wrote this book, The Only Way Out is In. I just thought, yeah,
yes,
that's a great title.
Yeah. And brilliant.
And great
title.
Advice. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there either a habit or just something you've noticed either in your life or with one of your clients that you can be specific about that you saw was, oh, wait, this is the old, or this is the paradigm we really want freedom from, and moved from that into the shift?
Yeah, I can certainly speak about that from my own life. You know, I'm retired now, although I'm teaching tomorrow at the university, and I do workshops. I'm doing one on Saturday and things like that. So I'm not really retired. But I've got more space in my life to consider some of these deeper questions and live them. You know, that's sort of the privilege that comes with,
right,
you know, reaching a certain age. But the interesting thing about it is that I noticed that I was writing about this stuff, you know, for many years in academic papers and trying to integrate it into my practice as a therapist when I was working for the health service. And, you know, it's always tough when you're trying to do this in an institution that doesn't understand what it is in people like myself who are trying to practice it, but also it's forgotten what it needs for its own health. And it's really tricky between the sort of tension between that, trying to manifest something like we're speaking about today whilst being in a working environment or in a social environment that has no relationship to that. And I found that I had to be quite skillful in the way that I managed my own relationship to this work. And I didn't always talk about it, but people knew what I was into. Some people would have nice conversations with me over lunch, and we'd have, you know, so it's not like it was just black and white. There was lots of movement, but the institution would necessarily, just to get by, wouldn't be able to integrate these more subtle realities into its way of being, because it just doesn't have any schema for that. But I think that it could, and it would profit and benefit all of us if our institutions did that. Schools, universities, hospitals, churches, you know, all of these places. If we had a bit more connection to these soulful ways of being and our needs as whole human beings, you know, we're not just social and psychological, you know, we're ecological, we're spiritual, soulful, and so much more. So I found that when I went to the university, when I first got the job, it's a very heady place, and I'm quite a soulful kind of person. I drew a picture of the school, because I'm quite artistic, so I drew a picture of the building, and then I put myself in some little tomb or something like that underneath the whole building, enclosed in it. And I thought, I don't even know why I did it, but I thought, oh, okay, why have I done that? And then I realized that I couldn't change the system, because that's just impossible, but I was incubating something. And I did incubate something. I did my PhD on spiritual crisis and collective transformation. I wrote a whole host of papers on dreaming and spiritual work, and I was encouraged to do that. So the system actually wasn't an adversary, but it doesn't know what it needs for its own progression in this time of degradation. And that's my difficulty with where we're at the moment, is how do we get those doors more open in our institutions to have these conversations? And so I drew this little tomb with me in it, and of course it was bearing fruit in some way.
Yeah,
because it's incubating.
A quick story. I don't know if you're familiar with Bruce Lipton.
Yes, very much.
So when he was doing research at Stanford, he was really, just for our audience's sake, he was a professor of medical cellular biology. And then the more research and the more he found, it's like, oh, wait, this system isn't really quite holding up. So he started doing research over in Stanford, and everyone would come to the lunchroom and they'd share what's going on. And he said everybody would be engaged in what he was talking about and going, yeah, oh my gosh, really? Yeah. This is amazing. But then they'd go back to their cubicle and go back to the system that was way in place and work from that being the base viewpoint. So it does take a while. But the fact that it's happening, I just love that vision of the entombed ideas.
I think systems themselves do take time to change.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember writing about spirituality when I was working in the National Health Service, and it was not anything at that time. And a lot of people thought I was a little bit, mixed a bit off beam writing about this stuff, you know. Some years later, then it got enshrined within the Department of Health manifestos. We need to focus on client spirituality. And now I'm at the university teaching the students about spirituality. And so, you know, it just shows that things do change. Yeah.
Right. It does feel slow, but I think it's so important that we are bringing up this perspective, because here in our lifetime, we've seen it go from zero to,
yes,
I'm not going to put a number or a place where it is now, but it is changing, and we need to really hold, yes, that and recognize it, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, I did a session at the university in August this year. It's a new one, and they asked me to come in and do some work around death and dying and spirituality. And I said, yeah, lovely, I'm glad to do that. And I put in some research about end-of-life dreams and visions. And I thought, okay, I don't know how this is going to go. But the students absolutely loved it.
Oh, I bet they did.
Because it was the first, they did. And because it was the first session, the person who asked me to do the teaching said, do you mind if I sit in on it? And I said, yeah, go for it. And so I started coming out with this stuff. And she said, wow, it was brilliant. I didn't know we would have this level of engagement, because I was giving stories of like people at end of life. And I said, sometimes what they used to do was medicate someone because it looked like they were going a bit delirious.
Yes, yes.
But actually, this group of researchers held the space and enabled those people to go through these dream encounters and visionary encounters. And they, in the main, about 80% of them profited greatly from that work.
Yes, oh,
so,
absolutely.
So, you know, that's it. That's it. I think it is starting to really, you know, we can bring more stuff in now. And yeah, but I think it's also up to us to push the boat a little bit and make that happen.
Well, it's interesting. I've heard many stories of hospice nurses after the doctor goes in to see the patient, and then they come out and they say, oh, give this person whatever drug. And the nurse will say, well, they're not going to be with us much longer, meaning they're going to pass in the next few hours. And the reason they knew that was because, basing it on the dreams or what the person was visualizing,
yes,
at the time, or,
yes,
seeing. So it's brilliant that,
absolutely,
it is coming together now. And I'd love to hear you share a thought or two about our mystical physiology, since we seem to be hovering there,
yes,
anyway.
Oh, lovely. Well, I mean, it's a subject that's very close to my heart, and I'm very passionate about it. You know, I feel I'm coming full circle in my own path, because all those years ago when I had the spiritual crisis or spiritual awakening, it was in a Buddhist monastery, and it was really a mystical opening. What I didn't have was the resources, community, or skills to help me integrate all of the complexes, psychological complexes, that were activated because of that experience. I mean, I was in a state of ecstasy, love, bliss for days. And then it went down into the more difficult stuff. So, you know, the dark, say it's a dark night of the soul, but something more to do with really meeting, you know, unconscious wounds and complexes that have been unresolved in us. So I faced all of mine, which took me years to work through. But having said that, the activation of those, as you say, that mystical physiology, you know, there was, in my experience, a classic heat in the belly, which is very, in Tibetan tradition, they call it tumong, you know, the inner fire. I was getting shakes in the hands, which is one of the things that happens when this is all activated. So it's all following a normal progression in terms of what we know. And, of course, the experience was being at complete oneness with everything. I mean, even litter on the street looked sacred. You know, I felt like,
right,
praying to it. You know, I was just walking down the street, chewing gum on the floor, and it looked like insanely, you know, beautiful. And I was just thinking, oh, you know, this is just a profound experience. And so I kind of then realized, oh, this is interesting, because you can have these openings and be stable in that and come through it, and great, no problem. That happens for many people. But there's people like myself who've got some, maybe some baggage from the past and unresolved stuff, that experience opens you up. And Michael Washburn, a transpersonal philosopher, calls it an eclipse of the ego. So when that
beautiful
sense of Yeah, it's a lovely way to describe it. What happens then is because the sense of being able to then manage, oh, why am I feeling a bit odd like this, or just got wiped out, and I just got exposed to the unconscious, and it kind of took over quite a bit. So there was a lot of integration to do and working through. So there's always that kind of difficulty with this work when we go. I would always say with going into the mystical stuff, and I think it's where we need to go, to be honest, because we're in a living mystery and we're interconnected with everything, and it's a beautiful mystery. But because our psychology has been so dissociated from the whole, naturally, when some of us have these experiences, we also have the wobble that goes with it, and we need to have that time for working and settling down, and then coming into that relationship again, you know, with that mystery. And for me, it's been a 30-plus-year journey, and writing the three books took 12 years, and that was my own sense of devotion to understanding, getting a real position on what had happened and why it happened, and coming back now, gradually, after all these years, back to my roots of being, you know, embedding a mystical practice in my daily life. So that would mean, you know, doing soul work and dream work, which I think is sacred, appreciating these subtle energy bodies that we have, the chakras, we might call them, and the nadis in the Indian tradition.
Yes.
And just finding a tradition and a path that helps us become a little bit more connected to that.
I think it's really what's
needed.
Yeah, and we have, since the days of yore in shamanic tradition, the wounded healer. And today,
yes,
I feel like there's just so many plain wounded out there. And I'm wondering if you could share some insight into how that transition, or what that transition from wounded to wounded healer or transformer, as you call it, can be made.
Yeah.
And obviously, sometimes, I mean, what the wounded healer is about is someone has experienced near-death experience, or they've had a horrific tragedy in their life, and they come out this other side. I would love to see coming out the other side without having gone through the tragedy or the tragic incident. What can you say about that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's really, I thought a lot about that, Robin, to be honest.
Ooh, more to come from Mick Connors next time Tributaries airs, which will be in 2 weeks. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are where you hope to find them, and if not, please let us know. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.